My name is Andrew Hunter. I'm the senior curator of the Art Gallery of Guelph, and I am here today with...
I'm Kazine Van Heuvelen. I'm an Inuk sculptor. We're currently in Bowmanville, Ontario, where I live, although I'm originally from Iqaluit, Nunavut, and I'd say my practice is based out of the north.
Yeah. How long have you been down here living in the Bowmanville area?
We moved down south around the time I started school, so I grew up in this area. And then lived away for a couple of years, and then been back a couple of years. Yeah, so most of my life in this area. This is the area my dad grew up in, so I guess that's why we came back here, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you work in a number of different ways, but you're primarily a sculptor. Like, you're primarily an object maker, and you work in... Maybe talk a bit about some of the different approaches that you take, or I mean, you have a shop here, you work in metal, you work in...
Yeah.
We're going to talk about some balloons too. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I think metal is what I often go back to. It's my dad was a welder, and I worked with him for a number of years, and so I mean, it's a lot of welding and grinding, and so that has always kind of come easily. Not easily. Come pretty fairly quickly to me, so I always kind of fall back on that, or I am comfortable exploring that, so that comes up a lot. And then a lot of my work is also material exploration, so if there's an interesting process, or I get an idea about how to make something, then usually a project will come out of that, you know, just out of wanting to explore some way of making that I haven't learned yet.
And talk a bit about the imagery in your work, where you draw that from.
Yeah.
Maybe use a couple of examples. You did a piece recently that obviously was referencing sort of fishing lures, but obviously, as you say, your work really comes out of the experience of the North and those roots in the North.
Yeah, so I mean, these fishing lures that I was working on earlier this year, some of them are based on, you know, lures that I've used, that I've, you know, been recommended and told her, like, you know, these are the good lures. This is fishing up north. I don't do a lot of fishing down south, but up north we do a lot of fishing. So it's always been a big part of being there. You know, are we going fishing today? Like, you know, I have a lot of memories kind of associated with fishing and these fishing lures, and, you know, going and finding fishing lures. The tides are pretty high. So, you know, you lose a couple lures when you're fishing at high tide, and then you go out and you find a couple new ones at low tide. But so some are ones that I have kind of memories of. Some of them are based on historical examples. So, like, examples of lures that were carved out of bone or of teeth, and then I've kind of enlarged those in wood or ceramic. And then a couple of the other lures are kind of just made up. Like, maybe based on shapes or designs, but just kind of not based on any memory or anything. Kind of just imagined, you know, would a fish like this, or would this look good as a sculpture, as a lure? And then other work just comes out of usually what I'm, you know, the types of things that I'm looking at. So whether it's, we're at my mom's place right now, and she's got a lot of, you know, interesting things here, a lot of Inuit art, and so some of that, like, I've been looking at for a really long time, and so that can creep in into my work. And then other things that I might just be looking at work themselves into pieces.
Do you collaborate much with others, or do you get involved in working with other people to fabricate things if you're not fabricating? I know with the lures, you had them cast. That's not a kind of collaboration, but, like, You're both fabricating, and you're also working with, like, people in industry to fabricate things.
Yeah, so some of the lures, not to talk about them exclusively, but I mean, I did some water jet cutting, or I'll go to a place that sells plastics or something. And yeah, there are all kinds of different industries that I'll explore.
Yeah. But Bowmanville's a good area for...
It is, yeah. There's a lot of, you know, machine shops, and there's a foundry.
I think we were talking before, my father worked in industry, and the company he worked for did a lot of casting for train brakes.
Right,
they had a lot of their work done here in Bowmanville.
So there's some, maybe it's not collaboration, but I'll Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, and it seems to go wrong more often than not. I like to keep a lot of, I like to maintain a high degree of control over over the production of the work. And sometimes when I'm feeling brave, I'll release that control a little bit.
Yeah. Which kind of brings us to one of the things I wanted to talk about today, which is the seal forms, the balloons. And maybe later you can tell the story of the spectacular kind of misunderstanding of dimensions of this. But just to kind of set up a little bit for folks, like this, I'm interviewing you as part of interviewing a number of people in relation to an exhibition that we've put together at the Art Gallery Guelph, and started from a response to Alethea Unercook-Burrell's Angry Inuk film. And then a group of college Inuit youth in Ottawa responding to seal bans, international seal bans, by staging a pro-sealing rally and fashion show and throat singing performances on Parliament Hill. So wanting to bring together a group of Inuit artists and students and young people to kind of reflect through art on this particular moment and the pressures on Inuit communities. So reached out to you because of this particular project that you've done, working with a form, a seal form, that manifests as these kind of balloons, both a smaller mylar, but also you've worked on the idea of a big one. Yeah. But so yeah, maybe tell us a bit about that. I'll get the title wrong, you told me before, so I'll get you to...
Yeah, Avatuk is the title, and an Avatuk is a tool used for hunting. It's a like one full seal skin inflated and tied off, so it's a float. So it's used with a harpoon, and then the harpoon is attached, like the harpoon head is attached to a line that it attaches to the Avatuk, and then that becomes a way to like track and tire the
like
the animal.
Like was used in whaling,
and yeah, in
like
whaling,
another,
yeah,
not just in Inuit but in other cultures as well.
Yeah, and so so I was thinking about that, and then it, of course it's a balloon as well, so
yeah, so it has a feel like it's a mylar. It feels like one of these things you would go
it's
to
a
buy anywhere in like the shape of Mickey Mouse or Happy Birthday.
Yeah, we see them all the time, but so I was thinking of them both as being like location markers, and these balloons are a familiar objects, and they kind of have these associations that are like good associations with them. So you know, you can initially the project was I had completed this work for Inuit Blanche a couple of years ago in St. John's. This was the first project where it seemed like an appropriate to actually make it. I was kind of sitting on the idea for a bit, but I made it for this event, and it was just a good opportunity to do this, because it was a celebratory work. Like it calls attention to, you know, a hunting practice, but it's also a really inviting and engaging work. It kind of moves around in this interesting way, and it's really approachable. And I wanted something that could start a conversation on that note.
I'm just curious about, I mean, one of the things that is raised by Alethea's film is, for those who haven't seen Angry Inuk, and you can see it both at the NFB site, you can see the full film, you can also see a kind of edited version at CBC, is, you know, wanting to address that by, you know, the basically what's happened over the years is with all of this pressure internationally on the banning of seal hunts, and largely the imagery that gets used repeatedly is of the clubbing of baby seals, which is something that Inuit never did or practiced. It's not part of the tradition. But that something that's really important culturally but also economically to Inuit communities is being like horrendously and detrimentally damaged by being lumped in with this bigger band. And how does a small, but you know, by population, a pretty small community of people spread across the North fight back? So yeah, I'm curious if you have thoughts about that, or even just the importance from your perspective of seal and seal hunt and hunting to Inuit communities.
Yeah, I think it's such a big part of our history and our culture, and it doesn't seem like it should be as big an issue as it is, you know. It's like it seems clear as day to us, but there's all kinds of outside pressure and organizations and who want to kind of crack down on seal hunting. But man, it's a difficult thing to talk about, because it's it doesn't make sense from my perspective, but you try to see the other side of it, but it still doesn't it doesn't add up the way.
Well, I think what's been difficult when as again in the film, in the Lithius film, and others have talked about, or Tanya Tagak has talked about, who's part of the project too, is there's this sort of lumping of the Inuit communities and economy and culture into something else, into something much bigger that is not necessarily related. And so often the imagery that's getting used by anti-sealing and environmental organizations is very much about the East Coast seal hunt of a certain kind of imagery of these little white baby seals and people clubbing. And it's like they tend to continue to use that imagery. And these are super well-funded organizations as well doing that work. And the irony, again, which Alethea talks about, is that, well, if it really is about environmentalism and protecting and sustainable communities' environments, then...
we have the bottle, then, it's sustainable hunting, it's a sustainable food source, it's also something that's already happening in Inuit communities, mm-hmm. is they're catching and eating seals, and I mean, that's going to keep happening. It's, one of the common food, and it's a healthy food, and it's an available food, and that's mm-hmm. I think we take that for granted down south, is that the availability of food that is nourishing. So sealing is going to be happening in Inuit communities, and when you make sure that a hunter can't make any money off of off of the furs, that doesn't do anything but hurt that community.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's an ongoing practice, and then, people have to be able to afford ammunition and gas and mm-hmm. everything to be able to continue to hunt. So it's whether or not people are going to be doing this in poverty or if they can...
And then what do people have to turn to? That's the other thing. It's like, if this isn't something that can be foundational to an economy and a sustainable economy, then what are the options that people have? And usually what's on the table is much more damaging and detrimental to the environment, if that's ultimately what people's concerns are.
Right? Yeah, and I mean, the first thing that came to my mind was mining, right? A lot of northern communities have mines nearby.
You were saying earlier there was a generation that chose art, or that art making was a certain, was an option for people, and a younger generation isn't really going that, the opportunities are there, and the resources.
Yeah, I think a lot of artists,
a
lot of the younger generation of artists are going working in mines because, it pays well, and if it's nearby a community, then a lot of the community ends up working there, and people have to, make a living somehow.
Yeah.
And so people will do something that's not, that they wouldn't usually be doing, make a living, but...
Yeah, it's hard to live in a poverty when things are happening around you and other people are thriving and the money's all leaving the region and it's all coming out of the community.
Yeah.
Those things are happening, right? Mm-hmm. I remember witnessing that up around Fort McMurray and lots of young Indigenous people being drawn in and into the industry, right? Because the money was really great and the companies were seeking people out because it was good optics for them, right? To be able to say how they were supporting Indigenous communities because they were employing young people and that sort of thing. Let's go back to the balloons and talk a bit about how, because we're on radio, how they're presented, how you decide how to set these up or install them, or how have you presented them? And then if you're okay with telling the story about attempting to make a really big one for Toronto, and it goes back to your story before about sometimes things and then being control, right?
Yeah, so I've exhibited them in groups usually, but I've exhibited between 1 and 12 of them. Usually it's 3 or 12 seem to be good numbers, but
and then a kind of a cluster
different heights and I was working with the Inuit Art Foundation for their booth at Art Toronto this past year. We had planned this kind of large scale version, and I was really excited about this, a giant version, and I had it in mind what it might look like, and so we were initially going to go with a 10-foot version, and so I got that kind of rolling, and then we realize, you know, it's not a huge booth. A 10-foot balloon is really going to take over the space.
It would basically be the booth. It would be a booth.
It would be, yeah.
Yeah, so, the staff would all be squished against the wall.
Yeah, so, but that was the scale that the companies that I was dealing with liked to work at. They typically, you know, put a gorilla on a dealership or, you know, something in the air, a blimp or something. But they were willing to do like the 10-foot version and a 5-foot version. So the 5-foot version I thought would, you know, was going to be a great addition to that space. But it was late to kind of to arrive. The timeline was pretty short. And then I was away. And I came back the night before our Toronto and then opened this package up. And it was a little bit... I was pretty shocked because it wasn't anything. I make it very clear what I'm looking for, and
right.
I should have been more concerned. He didn't want to work off of my blueprints. Like I have, you know, I have the blueprints, but he insisted that they make their own, and they have a team that works on these things. And, you know, that's fine.
But they basically got it backwards. That's kind of my understanding, right?
They got the proportions very off. So, I mean, I'm assuming they didn't understand what they were looking at, what they were seeing, first of all, in my images. So they had their take on it. And it came with these fins that were, you know, like three times the size they should have been. And they had this depth to them, so the fins are really thick. And the color was not what I was expecting. It was more of a gray, like a dull gray than a silver. But
so if you had to describe what this creature looks like, is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, it looks cartoonish. Like it looks like it doesn't look like a seal, no. And it looks like it's a translation of a translation of an object. So it's like a couple times removed from the initial thing. And I've already taken some liberties with you know, an avatar to make it more identifiable and a form that I liked. But so this looked very cartoonish. And my girlfriend said it looks like, you know, it's trying to give you a hug. It's got these big outstretched arms and it's...
I shouldn't be laughing.
No. We can laugh now.
I remember. Because I think I came by the ferry like 2 days later from this, and the folks were telling me, and I thought, that must have been really...
I ended up...
annoying and painful and difficult.
Yeah. But I was able to... I had some unfinished balloons that I'd been... that I hadn't finished for another...
So I was able to put together
three new balloons, and so I did, so I got back the night before, and I stayed up all night to get these, and then showed up because I didn't want to show up empty-handed, but I couldn't show this piece.
And you still feel that way. It hasn't, like, you haven't conceptualized.
No,
way to,
and
like,
I left today
to make a commentary.
I had it sitting in the living room for, you know, a month. Trying to think, you know, because I knew if I boxed it up, then I would just, you know, tuck it away and never think about it again, cut my losses on it. But so I left it out for a month trying to think, you know, what could I do with this instead? Like, this isn't, you know, hope isn't lost. There's something here. But, you know, now it's in a box.
So there's
it's
no,
like, I don't know.
There's no giant hug performance.
No. Well, yeah.
Not so yet. I guess the last, I'll just ask you quick too, like, just what are you working on these days, if you're okay to talk about that, or when are you heading up north again?
Yeah, well, I just got back from up north. I was in Baker Lake for a few weeks doing a residency at the Jesse Unark Center. So I was working on I started a series of prints, stone cut prints, and that I'm also doing a project at OCAD. As part of their renovations, I'm doing a series of stone cuts. So not the we're going to be displaying the
stone.
Large stones, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And probably won't do any prints off of them, but the idea being we can highlight a part of the stone cut process that people don't usually get to see. Everybody's familiar with the images coming out of, you know, Cape Dorset, King 8 Studios, and But everybody has this kind of, I shouldn't say everybody, but people have this kind of imagination about, you know, what it takes to make a stone cut. Mm-hmm. Usually a very romanticized kind of idea about what that means. Mm-hmm. And it'd be, I'm hoping to kind of show a bit of the process to highlight the,
nice,
you know, the, a step in that mm-hmm. process. And I'm doing a project in Saskatchewan as part of this roadside attractions project happening.
Yeah.
So I have an installation going up in Fort Capel in the next few months.
Wow, beautiful area too.
Fort
Capel Valley.
Well, I'm excited to visit because I haven't been there.
But now it's I've a done real so surprise, much research. Everybody has this idea of the prairies and it's flat, which the southern part is, but you're driving and then suddenly this remarkable river valley is just kind of totally unexpected.
Yeah, and I'm learning a lot more about Saskatchewan, about the, you know, more about different areas in the province, because there are a lot of different artists working in different mm-hmm. communities as part of this project. So it's highlighting a bunch of stops in mm-hmm. Saskatchewan. So, you know, I've only seen Saskatchewan through movies and TV, and that only gives you, you know, one mm-hmm. one perspective of yeah. the place. So I'm really excited to be working on that project. And
so the last quick thing, I guess, you mentioned working out of the Jesse Unark Center,
yeah,
and in Baker Lake, we have a substantial collection of Indigenous and Inuit work in particular that goes back 40 years. A large collection of work by Jesse. Is there any artist of that early generation of Inuit that sort of really strikes you, that you find, that draws you, right?
Well, Jesse Unark for sure. But
yeah,
I mean that's
yeah.
the.
It doesn't have to be Jesse because you were there. But I just was curious if there's somebody that you really think about or.
Yeah, well, a lot of different artists. Yeah. I think being in Baker Lake really got me thinking about the wall hangings differently.
Yeah.
You know, I've always loved them, but I had the opportunity to work on one.
Oh, like, well,
or
yeah.
on my own a little bit, so to learn. And it gives you a real appreciation for the amount of work that goes into mm-hmm. every wall hanging. And I should say also, like, I'm a big fan of Annie Taipano's work, because her stuff looks so much different than everybody else's.
Yeah.
It's got this, if you're not familiar with the work, it's like super bright all over, kind of like a really beautiful mess. Like, and I mean that in the
nice
in the,
way.
Yeah, the best way possible. And you can see her process in the in each piece, and it feels like a very freeing way to work.
Nice. Well, thanks for this morning.
Thank you.
And thanks for offering to include the balloons in the project. And then, looking forward to having you come to Guelph and see the collection and talking more about working together. So it's really good to see you.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you. Thank
You're
you
welcome.
For coming.
Yeah.